think every broadcaster has an ideal time of day that they seem to work best at. Artistic temperament, to me, is just plain bloody rudeness. The BBC is an institution I love deeply, but...
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Ken Bruce.
Well, I had a very nice childhood, very happy childhood. I was the youngest of four, so according to my siblings, I got the easy ride through childhood. You know, I didn't have any of the fights that they had to for their independence or anything like that. And, you know, probably that's fair because, you know, when I went through my teenage years, my mum and dad weren't particularly bothered about me. I could go out and come and go as I pleased, really. They weren't saying, you got to be in by 10 o'clock tonight or anything like that. As a result, I wasn't a particularly rebellious teenager, but I had a very happy childhood, just lots of fun and games. Didn't enjoy my school days particularly. It was paid for by my mum and dad. Actually, a lot of my friends went to the local secondary school, and you know, when I heard tales of what they were being taught, it sounded fantastic. It sounded much more general education than I was getting. The school I went to, they just educated you in the exam subjects, and only those exams that they thought you could pass. You know, if you weren't expected to do well in, say, Latin, you didn't learn a word of Latin or anything like that. You know, things like Greek mythology are still closed book to me. So I've got no friends from my school back then. I've got lots of friends that I was in social contact with outside school from that time. People I met in the Boys' Brigade and the local clubs, the tennis club and all that sort of thing. But not from school. It wasn't a particularly happy time. I did the bare minimum I had to pass the exams. Came out with the minimum university qualification, and then decided I didn't want to go to university because I'd had it to here with education. That I went into accountancy in the profession. You trained for 5 years and you came out a qualified chartered accountant. I lasted 2 years in that and dropped out.
You're listening to Radio Scotland on 242 metres in your medium wave band, and this is Stuart Henry, and now here come the number one.
As a listener, I'd hear the 8 o'clock news in the morning, and the Scottish news, and then I'd hear Pick of the Pops and Radio Luxembourg and Radio Scotland, 242, the pirate station in the 60s. No real thoughts of doing anything to do with radio, and no huge interest, just a general interest in music and wanting to hear a bit more.
Hello and a very good evening to you once again. The singers of last week's 1968 Screen Song medley were as follows. There was the group Traffic, then came Petula Clark, Ron Moody, Simon and Garfunkel, and Johnny Mathis.
The main person who I discovered, I discovered anyway, on radio was Ray Moore, because I didn't really start listening to radio seriously until the late 60s. And then I had a period when I left school, it would be about, 68, 69, when I was at home for about 3 months, because, you know, you do your exams and then you just disappear. You don't come back to school. And I was staying with an aunt because she had had some sort of family problem. So it was just up the road. And I was sent to stay in the house and kind of look after the house for her. And I found this radio and listened to people like Ray Moore. And I mean, I'd obviously listened around Radio 1 and everything, and I thought, there's a lot of people just kind of shouting and saying, aren't I great? And I thought, no, I don't really like that. I went to Radio 2 and the music was very strange, you know, stuff I'd never really heard before. However, I thought the quality of the broadcasters was terrific. It was hugely high. And people like Ray Moore particularly, I thought, now this is a guy who knows how to communicate. Listening to him at the time, I thought he was about 45, 50. It turned out he was in his late 20s only. But he had a mature voice and a genuine communicative style and a great sense of humour. And I thought, if that, I can do something like that, that would be what I want to do on radio. And he was a BBC announcer at the time and doing some programmes. And I thought, that sounds like a job for me, being a BBC announcer, because I found that they did lots and lots of things other than reading news and continuity. They did comedy shows and record programmes and symphony concerts and all sorts of work. So I thought, that sounds like a good job. And I'd read a book when I was about 15 by Jack DeManio, who was the presenter of the Today programme in the 60s.
You know, Professor, I mean, a lot of people think that you talk like this all the time, but of course that's nonsense, isn't it? Oh, no.
And
yes,
he was recounting his days as a BBC announcer, and they were all having such fun. They were all drunk all the time, coming out of pubs and announcing symphony concerts half cut. And these were adults, you know, and I thought they're behaving like kids and they're having a great time. This sounds like a fabulous job. And I, for no good evidential reason, thought I would like to do that. I had no reason to think I could ever get on the radio, but I thought I'd really love to do that job.
Hello and a very good evening to you. A warm welcome to this, the fourth concert in BBC Radio 2's series of the Festival of Music, featuring tonight the big band sound of this glorious team of visiting firemen we have on stage.
By the time
here.
I'd left school, I thought I'll just do something to pass the time, really. And I had made, at that point, I made a sort of a cursory effort to get into radio, and I sent off a letter to BFBS, British Forces Broadcasting Service. And they were very polite, and they asked me down to London, and I did a test for them, and they said, well, nothing really at the moment. But I got one encouraging word from the engineer who recorded me, saying, actually, you're better than most of the people we get through here. And I was standing outside having a smoke with him in the street afterwards, and he said, yeah, don't give up the idea. And I held on to that for several years afterwards. But I had no interest in accountancy. I just kind of drifted into that and then drifted back out again after 2 years. I took a little job, sort of summer job, washing cars, because a lot of my friends who were at university did this. They had a job as a car hire company who needed car washers during the summer because the business was brisk in Glasgow. Nobody, not very many people at that time in the late 60s, early 70s owned cars. So a lot of the working people of Glasgow hired a car for their holidays in the summer. And so the company that was hiring these cars used to massively increase their fleet for the summer months. And Glasgow Fair Fortnight, it was just hell on wheels. Everybody wanted a car, and they all went off in their cars. And we washed them and prepared them, and we had a great time, a lovely time. And I was earning a lot more because I was working long hours, earning a lot more than I ever was as a trainee accountant. So I thought, oh, this will do. They, spotted something in me. So they gave me an office job, and then I went up to assistant manager, and I was sort of, I could have had a career there if I'd wanted to, but, obviously still wasn't happy. But I got married in the interim, and I thought, well, I need to, just keep an income coming in and be responsible. However, at that point, I thought, well, if I don't do something about this now, I never will. I was 25, and I sent a letter up to the BBC, and they had me in, and again, it was kind of very nice, but nothing really doing. And somebody there said, why don't you try hospital radio? So I thought, oh, yeah, I never really thought of it. So I went down to Glasgow Hospital Radio and met Eric Simpson, who was running it then and ran it for many, many years. Great man, great man. And he put me on the air, and I just really loved it. It was like a duck to water. I loved it from day one.
And so for the next 180 minutes, let's just you and me sift through the dying embers of the old year, travel along the golden pathways of memory and hold hands in the darkness as we head towards the unknown promise of a brand new year.
I'd been listening a lot, and there were people I liked and thought, oh, that's how to do it, that's how they do it, and that's how I can take on that style of broadcasting, intimate, one-to-one broadcasting, making people smile, making people laugh if you can, and just generally being good company. And the best people were doing that, I thought, at the time, and not self-promotion. There was a lot of that going on radio at the time, people sort of building their own egos up. And I thought, that's not for me, but being a good communicator, getting over and working to people you don't normally mix with. You know, in hospital radio, you're dealing with a lot of elderly people. A lot of our stations, it was a station rather, that had about 12 or 13 hospitals we piped around, and most of them were elderly facilities. So a lot of our patients were elderly, and they wanted to hear Jim Reeves and the old Rugged Cross and all that sort of thing. And so you had to, it was a very early lesson for me in playing what your customers want, not what you want. Yeah, by all means, get your own taste in there. But remember, give your customers what they want. Educate them by quiet means, by nefarious means, but don't try and think you know better than they do. So the hospital radio was a great thing for me. And then I got lucky. The BBC, I heard on the grapevine through the people there, the BBC were looking for one announcer because somebody was leaving. And I got my tape up there and got an interview. And it turned out the person who was leaving didn't leave in the end. However, they heard something there, and there were already plans there for an all-day Radio Scotland This was before that happened. We were still opting out of Radio 4 at the time on BBC Scotland. So they very kindly took me on a short-term contract for the summer. You know, I had talked over my wife and said, will I go for it? She said yes. So I went for it, threw up the job, and went to the BBC in 1977 and never left.
Now it's time for Radio Scotland's gala opening night concert from the Kelvin Hall in Glasgow, where we now join my colleague there, Peter Easton.
Thanks very much, Ken. Well, this is a gala night for radio.
In fact, a new era of broadcasting in Scotland started today with the birth of Scotland's first national radio station, the new Radio Scotland on 370 metres and VHF.
I was continuity announcer that evening, and then having to do the late show, which was called Nightbeat, at 11 o'clock, I think, it began, because it was a strange schedule. But, yeah, I do remember that day. It was, strangely enough, I was regarded as one of the old hands, because even though I'd only been there a year and a half, they had taken on a whole lot more announcers and newsreaders and presenters, a lot of whom, hardly any of whom, had any experience at all. So I was actually training some of them, even though I'd only been there a year and a half, but I was the safe pair of hands that night in continuity, which I was a little miffed, I suppose, that I didn't get to do the big opening night concert. But I was on that opening day on Nightbeat, only an hour, I think. But it was good to be there on the very first day. And of course, it went through all sorts of changes over the next few years. It didn't start off that well and was not well received by the press and some of the public in Scotland. Pop, pap and prattle was the line that hurt the most, I think, which came out of the newspapers. It was a mixed bag of programming, and it didn't really work. It was trying to be too many things to too many people. But it was a brave effort, and it was needed, and it was possibly 5 or 6 years too late, but it got on the air, and I was very proud to be part of it.
Well, now, here's our first contestant to beat the band. It's Eric Cowley.
Hi, Eric Cowley, went to woo for gold rushes.
Hello, Eric.
Hi, Tony.
Hello.
Oh, I used to know your brother, Morris Cowley.
He died a few years ago.
Oh, yes, he's not in production anymore.
No.
Eric, who are you
talking about? Well, I was really quite happy doing what I was doing, because they split the base between Glasgow and Edinburgh, because the devolution referendum had was on its way, and they decided that they needed to move the radio newsroom to Edinburgh to reflect the growing influence of Edinburgh, because everything had been based in Glasgow. There was an outstation in Edinburgh, but it was really only for music and drama and stuff like that. News and current affairs came from Glasgow prior to that, but they felt that, you know, because there's a strong chance that a devolved parliament will happen, which of course didn't happen for many, many years afterwards, they moved the radio newsroom to Edinburgh. So it meant that because I was based in Glasgow, I didn't get to read the news. And even though I say it myself, I was quite a good newsreader and got the prime shifts prior to that. And I felt a bit, you know, miffed that I wasn't doing that, because I wanted to do everything. I wanted to do the disc programmes. I wanted to do the symphony concerts. I wanted to do newsreading and continuity as well. When newsreading was taken away, I thought, oh, right, OK. I did do the odd shift after that, but it wasn't part of my main activity. And I was given some programmes to do, sort of schedule fillers, that sort of thing. But again, there was enough variety to keep me interested. However, I thought this isn't going to be quite enough. So I started looking to move to London and do some announcing in London. And I started applying here, there and everywhere for those kind of jobs. I think by this time I'd gone freelance. At the end of 1980, I'd been doing a couple of programmes a week. It was a hodgepodge. It was just a kind of hour programme to fill a bit in the schedule. The rest of the day I was doing schools transmissions on VHF, as we called it at the time. So I was doing all sorts of strange stuff. But I had this little programme which was on 2-3 days a week most of the time. And at the end of 1980, they said, we're having a big schedule change. We'd like you to do a show 5 days a week on Radio Scotland, but you will have to leave the staff and become a freelance. This, of course, has had repercussions in recent years with the IR35 stuff, but I was told, yeah, you have to leave the staff, but, you know, well, don't worry, it'll all work out. So I really didn't think too hard about it. I left the staff and started doing programmes 5 days a week. And also by that time, one of my great friends and colleagues, David Finlay, had sadly but died, and he presented a Radio 2 ballroom series on Radio 2, obviously, which was just Scottish music from Scotland, and half an hour once a week for, you know, 13 weeks a year. So that was really my first outing on Radio 2, although it didn't feel like it because I'm still working in Scotland with Jim McLeod and his band and our local producer, Ben Lyons, and it just felt as if it was a Scottish programme. I didn't feel as if I was on Radio 2. But technically, that's where I first started. And then I got a little bit of depping work. It was about the only time I've ever consciously asked for work. I heard some people being tried out on Radio 2, and one of our own broadcasters had been down for a week to do some work. It was the wonderful Jimmy Mack had been asked to do a week on Radio 2, and I thought, well, you know, why don't I try it? And nobody had asked, so I wrote a letter to David Hatch, who was the controller of Radio 2 at the time, and said, you know, can I come and tell you about myself? So I popped in to see him, and he said, well, I know who you are. And I said, oh, right, okay. I said, well, I'd just like to work on Radio 2. I think it'd be, you know, I think I'd work quite well on Radio 2. And he said, well, I'm aware of you, so thanks for dropping in, bye. And I thought, well, that's that. He didn't like me, no chance of that. But lo and behold, just a couple of weeks later, I was booked to do a dep for Ray Moore, strangely enough, my favourite broadcaster. I did, I think, 1 week or 2 weeks, possibly, in September of 1982. And that was my first proper outing on Radio 2, and again, I loved it, and they came back from now and again to ask me to do more, and I did a bit of depping for John Dunn occasionally, and again for Ray Moore, and loved it, enjoyed myself, and they seemed to like me. That's when I felt, because much as I loved working in Glasgow, I felt to be on Radio 2, you had to be where everybody else was on Radio 2, and that was London. So I was in BH London in the old continuities at the back of BH, and I felt, this is it, this is proper, real, national broadcasting, and that's when I felt, this feels like home, and I hope one day it will become so.
Stereo Radio 2 from the BBC.
Everybody thinks they've had the best of the BBC. You know, they always think, oh, you know, it's not the way it was. And it's never been the way it was. However, it was good in the 80s. It was very strange, though, because I've been used to working in Scotland with programmes that were put together and produced and people there and in your ear. When I got to BH in London, I arrived on the Sunday, drove down, I think, and arrived on Sunday, parked my car in the back of Broadcasting House, and I thought, I'd better go in and have a look at the studio. So I went in, because nobody had bothered to think whether I could operate the desks or not. And they were Type-C desks with quadrant faders and Gates turntables and good old Sonifex cart machines. We'd been using Spotmasters recently in Glasgow, so this was great stuff. However, it was... there was no proper training. I just had a look. And then the following morning, I was to come in to do the show at 5 a.m. No producer present. There was not a producer present. I just had to pick up the box, the programme box, from control room, walk into the continuity where there'd be a TO, technical operator, and open the box. There's a lot of discs in there. Put them in the rack. And there's a little package of letters and postcards wrapped up in an elastic band, and that was your programme, basically, in a running order. The rest, you had to do yourself. Nothing wrong with that. I think it was a very good way to learn how to broadcast. But no producer in the building, and nobody came over until maybe Friday, when you were finished, because it was too early for any producer, any decent person to be up and doing. You were finished at 7:30 in the morning. Well, God, I'm not going to come into London for all that. So you didn't see the producer until, you know, during the day, you go over to the office in Charlotte Street, which again was about half a mile from the studios. The programme box was sent over by courier the previous day for your programme. It was just very odd because you were left your own devices and trusted to get on with it. And if you didn't get on with it, then, well, they didn't hire you again. So it was a kind of baptism of fire, but I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And the system of working has changed over the years. You now do get producers rather more involved in their programme. But previously, you know, they would do the plot for the week, the music plot for the week. They would rack up on the wall in their office on a Monday, and the secretary, as they were at the time, later PAs and BAs, they'd fill the programme boxes, put a running order in, and sent it over. And that was the producer's responsibility. What you said was entirely up to you, and if you got it wrong, they would come over and give you a rollicking, or you get a phone call. And if you got it right, that was expected of you. You don't expect praise for that. It was a very strange time, but changed now. Much, much changed.
This is Radio 2 on 1500 metres, 247 metres and stereo VHF.
It felt like a station for very much older people. The thing I felt at the time was, similar to my feelings at hospital radio, it's something I think people should still bear in mind when they join Radio 2, is that you don't just speak to your own age group and your people of your own interests or going through the same stage of life as you are at this point. It's people who are all different stages of life. It's got a wide demographic, Radio 2, and so there are a lot of older people, there were a lot of older people listening, but there were also, you know, mums and dads and kids listening. So you had to appeal to everybody. You can't just say, oh, isn't it awful because, you know, I've got a two-year-old child, all two-year-old children are awful, aren't they? And expect everybody to respond because, you know, some of them had children that were 30 or 40 and grandchildren, and some of them had not had children yet. Some of them were children themselves. So you just, you have to learn to speak to a wide range of people, and it's a good thing for people to learn to do, because otherwise it becomes just a mirror of your own interests, and you only speak to people that you're comfortable with yourself. And I think that's rather prevalent in radio at the moment. People who are they come in maybe not from experience from radio, but they come in and just think, I've got to talk, and I've got to talk a lot, so I'll just talk about the things that happened to me today. Well, they are interesting, I know, but you've also got to talk about the things that might interest other people and happen to other people. And I think that's a good lesson to learn. I learned it quite quickly at Radio 2 because it was necessary at that time. And I think other people could, these days, bear it in mind.
Tonight, from the Mermaid in London, we present conductor Stephen Bell, the BBC Concert Orchestra leader Cynthia Fleming, London Voices under chorus master Terry Edwards, all here, celebrating the centenary of pianist, arranger, composer, conductor, and friend of this programme, Stanley Black, in our weekly programme of Music for Everyone.
I started doing the Saturday Night Late Show, which was from 10 till midnight, and then it changed to 11 till 1. That was something I could do alongside my Radio Scotland work, so I was working really hard then. I was doing Monday to Friday Radio Scotland. It was, by that time, that was 1984, I was doing 2 till 5 every afternoon. And on Saturday, I was at 5 o'clock waving goodbye to the family and getting on the last flight to London from Glasgow Airport, staying over in London after the show and getting up and getting the first flight back on Sunday morning up to Glasgow, and then spending the rest of Sunday with the family, back to work on Monday in Scotland. So I was effectively 7 days a week at that time, and it was a bit tiring, and I was trying to do everything, of course. When you're young, you don't say no to anything. You just say, oh yeah, I'll do that. So any job that came in, I was doing. I've learned since then, you can't do it all. So I was really probably doing too much at that time. But again, I was on my beloved Radio 2, and I thought, oh, this will be very nice. I can keep this going for a while. That'll be great. And it did. It seemed to do quite well. It put the audience up a little. I don't think you can do an awful lot with figures. It's 11 o'clock on a Saturday night. But it seemed to work. It seemed to, hit the spot.
BBC Radio 2, Terry Wogan.
And for the final time, good morning. Dashed glad of your company. If you can spare any of it between now and 10.
I go on.
It's me final chance. One of the great openers, the Four Tops. Woo! Woo!
If I were a carpenter.
Well, I was offered the breakfast show because dear old Terry went off to television at the end of 84, and I was aware that Terry was leaving, and I thought, I'll never get that because, they'd be looking for somebody much more experienced and somebody much better known. I was not known at all in the South or anywhere outside Scotland, and I wasn't even that well known in Scotland.
A final Friday fling, a final Friday Fandango, hanging on grimly as ever here until 10 o'clock.
So when they eventually called me, I was flabbergasted, and I had to take a few days to think about it. In fact, Bryant Marriott, the controller, called me back and said, look, we really have to have a decision, if you don't mind. And I could see all the pitfalls that, you know, I wasn't going to be accepted very readily by a national audience, because they didn't know who I was, and they would think I was a usurper and somebody coming in just thinking they could reproduce the work of the great Terry and be brilliant, you know, and I never thought that at all. But I thought, if I don't take this, then I may not get anything else. What I'd actually hoped for was that somebody like David Hamilton would get the breakfast show and I might pick up his afternoon slot, as it was at the moment. That would have been the ideal for me. But they offered me the breakfast show, and eventually I said, well, I can't turn it down. So I took it, but it was with a slightly heavy heart, because I knew, or I hoped, that it would do really well and it would work brilliantly, but I kind of knew somewhere within that it wouldn't last and I would have to look for something else, probably quite soon.
Billy Preston and Cy Rita. It will come in time. It's 8:10. And it's Thursday today. This week has... well, it went very slowly to begin with. And now it's rushing by. Thursday the 14th of November, thanks to Ray, looking bright and fresh.
But I went into it, and it was... I became aware afterwards that not everybody... at Radio 2, there were two factions at Radio 2. There was the management, the directorate side, the controllership and his side, and then there was the production department, which was very strong at the time. And there had been some difference of opinion. Some people thought that I wasn't the right for it, the right fit for it. And I look back on it, and I think it may have been, I may have been part of the power struggle. It may have been somebody saying, I'm going to, you know, impose my person on this recalcitrant production house who don't want him. Yeah, and I think, well, you know, who runs this place? It's going to be, it was a power play, I think. I was aware during that year that there wasn't a lot being thrown at the programme to help it succeed. The slot was terrible anyway, because it was 8:07 start. Now, for a breakfast show, you can't start at 8:07. It was after the 8 o'clock news and 7 minutes past 8. So Ray Moore had been, he had his show extended from 5 till 8. So he was working 5 till 8 every day. And I was on 8:07 until 10:30. So it wasn't really, it was already pretty much a mid-morning show even at that time. So it just couldn't last like that. And I knew the writing was on the wall when, you know, I was aware that, you know, I was getting lots of nice letters, and I was getting a few rude letters as well, of course, which you do on radio, that's all right. But I thought, I need some content in this programme. I wasn't being given anything. So I said to my exec producer, who was a lovely guy, I said, could you see if I can get some newspapers? Can I get the newspapers? And I can go through them at least and give me some talking points. And he said, all right, I'll go and sort that out. And he came back the next day and said, well, I've asked the bosses, and they said, no, you can't have newspapers. I said, well, why not? And they said, well, because, you know, Gloria is in the on the afternoon, and she uses snippets from the paper sometimes in her programme. And that was the moment I thought, well, if you can't provide newspapers for your breakfast show, then, you know, your heart's not in it. And I thought, that's it. It's never going to work. And so I was just waiting for the chop after that, and there was a bit of a shuffle in management, and I was duly chopped at the end of the year.
There's magic in the air.
Radio 2 has a new sound this spring. Your favourite Radio 2 personalities, with more tunes, more melody, more of your kind of music. Quizzes, comedy, and of course music round the clock, with a new voice at breakfast time.
Do they mean me? They surely do.
Across the UK, I mean, I was glad of the opportunity. I don't care how it came about. And you get lucky sometimes. And I felt, although it didn't work out, it was very lucky for me, because it got me onto the station. And in the short time I was on the breakfast show, it was a year and a quarter, it was seen when I was taken off, I got a lot of support from, you know, listeners who said, oh, that's not fair, you know, give them a chance. So, you know, it did work to my favour in that people said, you know, it forced people to make a choice. And a lot of people, I'm pleased to say, said, well, actually, he's quite good. And I remember there was one lovely critic, he was a critic at the time, a great comedy writer, Barry Took, who, the first week I was on, he wrote a rather scathing review about me for The Listener. And I thought, oh, okay, right, it's a bit hard, but, you know, fair enough. However, the next year I met Barry and he said, I realised I was completely wrong about you. I just needed time to get used to you and to understand your sense of humour. And I said, you wouldn't like to write that again now, Barry, would you? He said, well, no, I don't have the column anymore, unfortunately. But you do need time. Radio needs time. If you're going on any station, you can't just expect to make an impact within 3 months. Some people do. But sometimes that initial impact fades after the 3 months. And some people are slow burners. And I think I was a slow burner. It took people a length of time to get used to. A lot of people thought I was just rude at times because I would be slightly sarcastic and take the piss, basically, out of people. And people say, oh, that's very rude. He's very sharp. I don't like him. And I think it just takes time for people to realise you're not being serious. You are just making fun and you're digging people in the ribs. It's a very Glasgow way of doing things, actually. It's a very West of Scotland thing. You know, you've got to be able to withstand a bit of ribbing, a bit of banter, as it's now referred to. But it's meant as respectful. It's not meant to be cruel and to rub your face in it. So it took people a while to get used to me. But, you know, I survived the cull. In that I got a mid-morning show after that, and after a bit of negotiation, I managed to hang on in there. I felt that mid-morning was absolutely right for me because I don't seem to work as well late in the day. I've had a late night program on a few occasions. I just don't seem to, you know, work. It's part of my mindset in that I get up in the morning and think I'm going to work today. And if I'm doing a show in the morning, then at 12 o'clock, I'm not going to work anymore. I've done my work. If I'm doing a show at 10 o'clock in the evening, then the whole day I've got that thought in my mind, I've got that show to do. So, you know, bear that in mind. Don't go too far away. You might not get back. You know, you can't go to a pub and get drunk because, you know, you've got to be sober for the evening. You can't stay and enjoy a meal because you've got to be back at the studio by 6:30. So it just, you know, it's hanging over you. So, and by 10 o'clock, you know, my body clock is sort of telling me go to bed. So that wasn't a particularly successful late night broadcaster, I don't think. But the mid-morning suits me perfectly. And I think every broadcaster has an ideal time of day that they seem to work best at. I've done early mornings and I've done, you know, the breakfast, just a vague breakfast time. And I seem to be right at 9:30. I feel right and what I do seems right. I think everybody has their optimum time to be on air. And I seem to have hit mine quite early on and managed to hang on to it.
Tuesday morning, 17th, and it's full of coded messages. Just don't suppose Ginny is this new woman in charge of MI5. I'll take care of the physio. Tell him, Mungo McCleary of Chobham in Surrey. All my love. No Christmas together this year.
In the 80s, 90s, new year, perhaps. It was a lot of requests. We had a lot of requests at that time. And some of them were, you know, a bit depressing in that they were songs from the 30s, you know. Now, whereas in 2020, you asked for a song from 50 years ago. Well, that's 1970. That's, you know, that's great. That's recent. However, in 1980, if you asked for a song from 50 years ago, you were getting songs from the 30s, and it was just a very, very different kind of music and made the station sound pre-war, basically. And so much had happened post-war. Rock and roll came along and changed all of music. And that's why, you know, now in Popmaster, we can have questions going back to the 50s, nearly 70 years ago, 60 or 70 years ago. If we'd been running Popmaster in 1980, then, oof, you know, would you have played music, you know, ragtime music from 1920? Certainly not. Would you ask questions about that? No. So things like that have changed. You know, the span of time that people like music for has changed. And the type of music people are prepared to listen to has changed as well. And it can be very gradual, and sometimes it can go too fast, and sometimes go too slow. But the music has changed a lot. Although, you know, there's still a lot of stuff I was playing in 1980 that still comes in there. And the style of broadcasting is now much more relaxed. We were, I think all of us, back in the 80s, 90s, still quite a bit of RP, still speaking the Queen's English, and still enunciating beautifully. And, you know, since the late 80s, 90s, I have, you know, much more gone back into natural Scottish speech and sounds. When I was newsreading in Scotland, we were required to do pretty much RP, a Scottish, slightly Scottish RP, but you weren't supposed to sound particularly Scottish. So we had to do that, had to sound like that, and also sound a little more relaxed when we're doing programmes. Now, the requirement to pronounce your G's all the time has gone. And so you can be a little more natural in your speech. Obviously, I still like to speak beautifully. I'll try to. But things have changed in what the public will accept. Although you still get a lot of complaints about people who can't speak the Queen's English properly. So, you know, old habits die hard amongst our listening population. And remember, we do have an ageing population. So people who are age 90, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, not many people made it to late 90s or 100. I mean, every day now when I'm doing my love song dedication, that's one song in the programme, every day I'll get somebody who's got 100 or more than 100. That never used to happen. That used to happen once every 6 months. So we've got an ageing population who still want to be entertained, and providing, you know, a station that covers everybody from the age of, say, 35 or 40 up to 95, 100, that's a challenge.
We're with you night and day across the UK. It's Radio 2.
Oh, yeah, they put me on at night again, which, as I was indicating, is not my favoured time. But, yeah, I took it on the chin. I wasn't happy. I felt that I'd been ousted from a show that I had actually done quite well in. But the controller at the time was very supportive and was saying, no, look, this is very important for us. And you're opening up nighttime, you're extending daytime into the late evening. This is the idea behind this. So you're going to do a show from 10 till midnight, four nights a week, and it's going to be very important. I mean, I didn't really buy it, and it was being sold as a promotion, but I wasn't terribly happy about it. However, you know, we tried to make a good show out of it, and I think we did. Phil Hughes was our producer at the time, and I think we did a nice show out of it. But by the end of the year, again, the body clock was saying to me, you know, I don't like this. And the controller had said to me, you will go back into daytime sometime. Just, you know, if you could do this for us, that would be great. So I went to her at the end of the year and said, I'm really not happy doing this. Can you offer me anything else? If not, you know, I will have to kind of look around. And to her great credit, she said, right, we can swap you with Chris Stewart, who's doing the earlies, and he doesn't particularly seem to like doing the earlies very much. So we swapped shows, and Chris took on 10 till midnight, and I took on the 5 a.m. show. No, I think it was actually 6 a.m. 6 a.m. it started at that time. I was much, much happier. And the first day I did it, dear old David Hatch, who was by that time the head of All Radio, he'd been the man who'd first given me a gig on Radio 2, he came into the studio and said, can I just say, I'm delighted to have you back in the mornings. And I said, well, I'm delighted to be here. That's music to my ears. So I was back there early mornings, and then the following year, I was back in at 9:30. And there I was at 1992 at 9:30, and there I've stayed. I mean, it sounds as if it's been, you know, I dug in, and it's been just contracts of 1 or 2 years. The maximum contract I've ever had is 3 years, and only one of those. Every other time, it's been a couple of years. 1 year, for a long time, it was just 1 year. So you have no guarantee of continuity in your work, and it keeps you fresh. It actually keeps you on your toes. You think, right, okay, got to make every show good. Wonderful way of keeping you concentrated. As you get older, as I get older, certainly, I appreciate, a contract of about a couple of years, because it just gives you a little idea that you're going to be there for a while. But if I'd known then I'd be here so long, I'd have done a lot of different things in my life, I think. And I probably would have just, I wouldn't have, I think I like to think I've developed over the years or changed slightly by, you know, just listening to what's going on around you. And I think if you know you're going to be in a job and you cannot be got rid of, there is a tendency to just dig in and make no changes at all. Think, well, if it was good enough for 1983, it's good enough for 2023. You can't do that in radio. You've got to keep your ears open, keep an eye and an ear on everything that's going around you. Listen to what other people are doing. You just take it in by osmosis, really. You don't have to think about it. But if you close your ears and don't listen to it, then, you know, I've heard a few broadcasters who have done that and still, you know, broadcasting as if they were in the 50s, 20 or 30 years later, and you can't do that. You've got to listen to how society is changing, what terms you can and can't use, how people are sensitive about things, and just be sensitive yourself to how society is changing.
Pop Master with Ken Bruce on BBC Radio 2.
From Newent in Gloucestershire, it's Diana Hanley first. Good morning, Diana.
Good morning to you, Ken. How are you?
I'm very well.
Pop Master really only developed very, very slow development. We just started it, a short-term quiz. Colin Martin, he said, we should do a quiz, really. And I said, well, look, you know, Ed Stewart's doing a quiz in the afternoon, and it's a very general knowledge quiz, but it was being done within the department. It was being done by producers and researchers and PAs. And quite often the answers were wrong, you know. I said, okay, you know, because every other day they were correcting something they said the day before, and I thought, this isn't good enough, you know. So I said, if we're going to do a quiz, it's got to be absolutely right every day. It's got to be absolutely unchallengeable. Nobody is going to be able to phone up and say, yeah, you got that wrong. So we said, well, why don't we do pop music? And we got Phil Swern in. And Colin and Phil and I went out to lunch one day, and we sat down and thought, right, let's get a format for this quiz. So we just sort of hammered something out, you know, over a bottle of wine and or a couple, and we got the format right. And then we said, right, fantastic, we'll start that. So then the next day, none of the three of us could remember what the format was because nobody had written anything down. So we had another lunch and another couple of bottles of wine, but this time we took paper with us and wrote down the format, which is largely... in fact, I think it's entirely the same as it is now. Two rounds, 10 questions each, three of them bonus questions, and then a 3-in-10 decider at the end. So it started then, I think it was 1998. Again, you know, nobody's really taken a note of this. 1998, and it has. We've tried a couple of different things through the years. One producer came in and said, right, why don't we split it up and, you know, do one round at 10:30, another round at 11:30 or something like that. And we tried that for a few weeks and that didn't work. And then somebody else said, well, why don't you have both contestants on at the same time and ask them questions, and if one doesn't get it, the other one can have a go at the question, right, in each round. And we tried that, and I simply could not keep track of the score. It was absolutely impossible to give somebody a bonus point and then keep running out. Oh, gee, and I was going mad with that. So we stopped that after about 2 weeks. And apart from that, we've just kept it exactly the same. And, you know, the first 5-6 years or so, it's going all right. Keep doing it. You know, it's not a problem. And then it just very slowly, around about, you know, 2002, 2003, it just started, you know, being something that you heard people talking about a bit. And then that's just grown and grown and grown. And people now, you know, in recent years, with people saying, well, you know, all of our work stops at Pop Master. You know, we don't take deliveries at 10:30. We don't hold meetings at 10:30. There are dentists who won't have an appointment at 10:30, and that sort of thing. So without trying to, it's become an appointment through the day. You know, a must-listen appointment. And, you know, I'm really proud of the fact that it's the spike of the day in Radio 2 listening, and in fact, in all listening. So it's proved its worth over the years, and I'm very, very proud of it, because we were in there at the start and we thought, we'll do something that is a good quiz. It's not easy, shouldn't be easy, shouldn't be impossible either, but it should be a kind of almost university challenge of quizzes for everyday people. And people love to think they know about pop music. And all types of people, you know, I've had politicians say, oh, I'm always listening, I'm doing Pop Master every day. But people who work in the essential services, they can't stop, but they do try and listen. So I'm delighted. I'm very, very proud of it. And I hope we'll keep doing it for a long time to come. The reason for playing the long song was because we've had 20 minutes of speech. You'd need something just to redress the balance, the musical balance of the programme. And so we felt a long song at that point is the ideal way of just getting... And you don't get a chance to play long songs on radio as often as you could. And there were a lot of great songs, you know, Billy Joel, Scenes from an Italian Restaurant, and MacArthur Park and all these, that, you know, need to be played every so often and don't get played perhaps as often as they were. So we dropped those in. But it is not a comfort break. Occasionally, of course, I will go for a comfort break at that time, but mostly it's for genuine musical reasons. I've loved the job that I've had. Absolutely loved it, and I still love it. Honestly, if I didn't, I couldn't do it, because I have a great time every day. I love being on the radio. I love the contact you get with listeners. It's so much more instant now that we have all these different forms of communication. I mean, the postcards that we used to have were lovely, but, you know, they didn't arrive until 3 days after you'd actually said what they were referring to, so it made conversations a little difficult. But the instant reaction you get now, and the warmth and the love you get from listeners is really, it's so heartwarming. It makes it all just a fabulous experience. I just love doing it every day, and you know, I always come off air better than I went on. I feel as if I've had a lovely therapy session all morning. Because, you know, if I've got a bit of a cold or a bit of a throat and I'm feeling a bit miserable and I go on air, by 12 o'clock, oh, this is great, I'm feeling fantastic. The adrenaline helps, you know, and, you know, you just it's like free therapy. So it's been a lovely job to have, and I'm still going to carry on doing it. And I think you find a lot of people who enjoy radio and love radio, they never really give it up. You know, if they get sacked from their job or they lose their job or retire, they end up on hospital radio again, or, you know, reading letters for the blind and things like that. You can't stop doing it. And I intend to carry on until the day I'm carried out feet first.
Hello and welcome to the 35th Eurovision Song Contest. Yes, 35.
I started doing that because Ray was ill, and he was the radio commentator for Eurovision prior to that. And Terry, of course, was the television commentator. And in 1988, Ray fell ill, and I was asked if I would go out to Eurovision instead. And I sort of thought, well, I better check with Ray, who by that time had become a really good friend. And I phoned him up. He said, oh, yes, of course, do it. You'll be great, you know. And I said, well, look, I'll just do it this year, and, of course, you'll come back and do it next year. And he said, yeah, of course. So I went, and I enjoyed it, and I thought, well, that's it. But then, sadly, Ray died at the end of that year, the cruelest death for a man who was a broadcaster. You know, he had mouth cancer and lost his beautiful clarity of speech. And I thought, you know, that is just, you know, thank you, God, kind of moment. You know, thanks for that.
Well, it's a Thursday today, which will jolly well have to do, the 28th of January. Thanks, by the way, for all the cards and letters and stuff, all sorts of bootlicking notes coming in from all and sundry.
It was really the cruelest thing that could happen to him. But Ray, as I say, sadly died. And so therefore, the following year, I was asked if I would do it again. I've been doing it ever since, because it's great fun. I never, you know, I liked watching Eurovision, obviously, everybody did at the time. I'm not a Eurovision nut. You know, I don't do the stats, I don't do, you know, who was, you know, we'd occasionally had Eurovision topics on Popmaster, and we rather quickly found out there isn't a question you can ask that they can't answer. They know more than we do about anything to do with Eurovision, and it's a limited subject. So, I mean, unless you're going to start asking the names of the audience in the Dublin showground at the Eurovision in 1990, you know, that's the only question you could ask that could actually stump them. So I'm not at that level of Eurovision interest. I have no real interest in it the rest of the year. It's just that one night. I don't even like the semi-finals. I like the final. That's the only night I want to be interested in. And it's the only night I think the majority of the British public are interested in, that grand final. Because it's a night of celebration that evening. We all kind of watch Eurovision for various reasons. And we all love it. So my job, I feel, is to be the voice in the kitchen while somebody is preparing the food and drink for the people who are watching the television next door. And they can still catch hold of what's going on in the kitchen while they're slicing up the lemons for the gin and tonic. So I do description of what's coming up, and I take the piss as much as I possibly can. Less so now than I used to, I think. But still, I like to have a wry look at what's going on at Eurovision. But it's a spectacular event, and unless you've been to one, I don't think you really understand how massive it is. And it's got bigger and bigger over the years. When I first went to it, it was held in theatres, and, you know, the Dublin Showground in, you know, in Ireland, that was a big departure because it took, several hundred people. But mostly, you know, it was hundreds of people rather than thousands. And now you're getting basketball stadiums that hold up to 20,000 people. And, you know, it sells out every year, no matter where it is. So it's a huge event. But it's also a very nice event. People get on. The people who are contesting, the singers, the actors, the dancers, the producers, they all get on really well. It's a big party, and it's a wonderful thing to experience, and it's a wonderful thing to go to. If you're a member of the UK delegation, it can be a deeply depressing thing to go to, because we haven't done tremendously well. But, you know, we go into it every year with a great confidence and a great optimism, and one of these years, I hope I live long enough to see another UK win. I've only seen one, which was Katrina and the Waves in 97, so 23 years is a long way. Let's have another.
Shine a light in every corner of our hearts.
Well, yeah, the BBC is an institution I love deeply, and I believe in it deeply. But when I joined the BBC in 1977 as a contract announcer, three-month contract, I thought, oh, this is wonderful. I've always wanted to work here. I think it's great. I was slightly surprised to find in Broadcasting House Glasgow there were only two television studios and about seven or eight radio studios. And I thought, this is a massive building. What do we do here? So, unfortunately, it's always been overmanaged. You know, I do sometimes think that a cull of managers would be no bad thing. And every so often they say, yeah, we're doing that. We're going to cut the management layers. And somehow, you know, even if they do, they come back within a few years. And I think it's often forgotten that the people who matter in radio, particularly radio, that's mainly what I know about, the people at the coalface, they're the people who are on air, the broadcasters themselves, the producers and the production staff. And after that, you know, you have to say, okay, justify your existence. Okay, do we need people to do this? Do we need people to do that? Yeah. And unfortunately, being part of the BBC, the budgets that we have, we're having to pay for, you know, part of our slice of the licence fee has to pay for the Director General's car, you know, and things like that, and a policy unit. And I said, how much does Radio 2 need a policy unit dealing with government and things like that? So it's a frustrating place to work sometimes. I remember the first day I started, when I'd always wanted to be in the BBC and be an announcer, at least certainly for the last previous 10 years. And the personnel manager who introduced me that day said, well, where do you see yourself going in the BBC? And I couldn't understand what he was talking about. I thought, no, I'm on air. That's all that matters in the BBC, isn't it? But he said, well, of course, there's all sorts of management opportunities. You could be running this, running that. And I thought, why would I want to do that? Why would I be interested in that? I'm going to be on air, which is the job in radio. And if you can't be a presenter or a producer or a production member of staff or one of the engineers who get you on air, these are the vital people. And everything else, you have to think, well, please justify your existence to me. And then, you know, I'll happily say, if we absolutely need you, then that's great. But, you know, the basic thing is the programmes. And once you start, you know, forgetting about them, then you're in trouble. And it was always said there was a famous part of the BBC called the Programme Prevention Department, which existed purely to stop you getting your ideas on air. And I'm afraid sometimes that can seem like that at the BBC. As I say, I'm a huge admirer of the organisation, but you can scratch your head sometimes and see itself shooting itself in the foot. And you think, please, please don't do that to an organisation we all love.
21 minutes to 10. Congratulations to Laura Trott and Jason Kenny, who got married at the weekend. But I noticed some of the papers are saying it was in a secret ceremony. It wasn't a secret. There were dozens of people there. It was just wasn't a secret. It was just private.
I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor in radio. And I've been very, very lucky, because a lot of people who are terrific broadcasters are not in work at the moment, and I've been very lucky. And I've dodged a bullet a few times. I mean, I've been on my way out the door a couple of times, and then events have somehow saved me. So I've been lucky to survive this long. I don't really have any regrets, because any decisions I made, and mostly, as I said, I haven't taken any conscious decisions. I've just done what was offered, or thought, you know, oh, I'll hang around for another year. As I said, the only conscious decision I took was to write to David Hatch back in 1982. Since then, it's just been, you know, will you do this, will you do that? And I've said either yes or no. So I've just thought, I'm enjoying this, enjoy the moment, and don't look too far ahead. So I've no real regrets. No, I've been doing a job I love for a long, long time. I hope to continue doing it for a while yet. And so to say I have regrets, well, yeah, it'd be ridiculous, really. Some say, well, wouldn't you have wanted to make it big on television? No, absolutely not. I don't see the two, radio and television, as being complementary in the slightest. I mean, a lot of people who are good at television, a lot of people who are good at radio, rarely, very rarely, can they do both. And some, you know, well, usually they do one better than the other. So I've never had any interest in television, so I've got absolutely no regrets about that. I don't mind appearing on it occasionally, you know, waving, showing, you know, showing the face, but it's not, you know, say, oh, would you like to do a game show? No, absolutely not. Would you like to be the presenter of Newsnight? No, absolutely not. Not suitable. So no regrets, really. I've had a blessed time on radio. I've worked with some lovely, lovely people. There've been the odd moment where I've felt, oh, this isn't very nice, is it? But mostly, you see, you get on air and you think, ah, it doesn't matter, does it? You're having a lovely time, you're talking to your audience, and if you come off here and the management are not being particularly nice to you, see, that doesn't happen very often, but it has occasionally in the past, well, you just think, ah, well, I'm getting on with it, and what's the worst that can happen? They can get rid of me, and I'll go and find something else to do. So, no regrets at all. I've loved it, and if I can carry on doing it for a bit longer, I'll love it even more.
I have French and Saunders in the studio.
Yay!
Lovely to see you this time.
Yes.
It wasn't quite so lovely to see you the last time.
Yeah, well, we had to tidy up.
I don't think it's that bad.
I don't know what you do in here. I can't believe
it. I don't know that I've managed myself. I've just been myself, really. I think some presenters think that they are the be-all and end-all. And I was saying that, obviously, the presenters, producers, production staff are, you know, the vital people in radio. But if you think you are more important than your producer or your production staff or the technical people who are getting you on air, if you think you're more important than them, that's the wrong attitude to have. You know, if you start bullying people or being unpleasant to people and then trying to excuse it by saying, oh, it's just my artistic temperament, I don't buy that at all. You know, I'm sorry, artistic temperament to me is just plain bloody rudeness. So I think, you know, you learn to be polite to people, you learn to respect other people. And yeah, I mean, I've had my odd blow up, but not at people. I explode at situations that happen, and usually it happens because somebody's not invested properly in something higher up the management chain, or they haven't thought of some problem that could have happened. And these are the only explosions I have. I don't shout at people that I work with unless, you know, I think I've only shouted at somebody once, and that's because they were being, less known. I think I felt they deserved it. But yeah, I don't think, you know, if you're rude to people, you don't deserve their respect. And so what's the point, really? You know, you've got to work with people. And if you can't work with people, then I'm sorry, you cannot rely on saying, but I'm a genius, because I don't think I've ever met a genius in my life. If I've met people who are very, very good at their job, but they're not geniuses, so don't think you can behave like one. I'm not one of these people that thinks, oh, yeah. Somebody once said to me, somebody in management said, because I was having a little difficulty with something at the time, and I said, well, you know, it's not really worth hanging on for this kind of thing. And this person said, you've got to think about your legacy. And I said, well, no, I won't have a legacy at all. If anybody remembers me, it would just be, oh, that bloke who was on the radio, he was okay, wasn't he? That's as much as I expect or hope for. I would be frankly embarrassed if there was anything more than that, if anybody thought, oh, he was, you know, if you start being overpraised, and this is where, you know, the bad behavior comes in, if you start being overpraised, then you start believing you are that genius figure, and that leads to a lot of difficulty in your own life, not as much as for anybody else's. So, no, I don't expect to be remembered. A nice headstone would be lovely, but that's about it. And he did all right. You know, he was good at his job. That's all I want to be remembered for.
Ken Bruce. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.
I'm David Lloyd, and if you enjoy radio reminiscences, then do grab my book. It's called Radio Moments, looking back through the last 50 years through my own eyes in and out the industry. That's called Radio Moments. It's available in ebook or paperback.